We are all experiencing history today. The U.S. Supreme Court overturns Roe v. Wade. Demonstrations continue in Washington, D.C., and reaction continues across the country, including here in Washington State. Let's go to former State Supreme Court Justice Phil Talmadge. First of all, Phil, did this surprise you at all?
Well, not with this conservative majority on the U.S. Supreme Court, Dave, unfortunately. But the breadth of what Justice Alito did in this opinion is far beyond abortion, by the way, and it's what's really concerning about this opinion. I mean, not to lose sight of the fact, I mean, the Roe decision was based on an older case called Griswold versus State of Connecticut, where the state of Connecticut banned contraceptives. And the Supreme Court said, well, there's a right of privacy inherent in the Bill of Rights of our Constitution. And that was the predicate for decisions like Roe and Casey. Well, Justice Alito says there's no such thing as a right of privacy in the Constitution, which means things like the right to contraceptives, the right to gay marriage, the right to all sorts of personal relationships that are built upon a principle of federal constitutional privacy are at risk.
Does this overturn all the attempts to stop internet companies from selling our personal information?
I don't know about that, but it's an incredibly damaging opinion. I mean, it's from a legal standpoint, it subverts a whole decades long progression in terms of the right of privacy built into the United States Constitution, and it basically says ain't there. And it's typical of this court. I mean, this is a court of conservatives who said, well, we believe in the principle of precedent, stare decisis. We believe in the original text of the Constitution. Well, they don't in either case. They don't believe in the original text of the Constitution when it comes to the Second Amendment. They don't believe in the right of precedent when you've got decades-long privacy built into the United States Constitution by precedent. Nope, we're going to walk away from that just because that's our political preference. This is a court that's out of control. It has no bearing on the Constitution itself or precedent. So it's basically engaging in political gamesmanship, just as Republican politicians have promised for decades.
So what happens next if we have an out-of-control Supreme Court, an incredibly divided Congress, an America that is at each other's throats? What do you think happens next here?
Well, Colleen, it's a perfectly legitimate question. I don't know. I mean, what I strove for when I was a state legislator, as Dave knows, I was there 16 years in the Washington State Senate. I mean, I worked with Republicans, worked with Democrats. We found common ground. These days, people aren't attempting to find common ground, and we need to start looking to those kinds of political figures across the country who can find common ground, who can get something done, like the legislation that was just passed on firearms. I mean, at least it's a step in the right direction, and at least it's an attempt by people to find common ground. We need to do that more in our political system, but if you have people like Justice Alito, who's a flamethrower, in the United States Supreme Court, writing opinions of this sort that abrogate decades-long federal privacy rights in the United States Constitution, I mean, you've got real problems, and it's going to suggest, I think, for the upcoming elections, that elections mean something, and people better start looking to who gets elected and how they're going to be reacting to the appointment of federal judges, both at the trial level and at the appellate level and at the United States Supreme Court level.
In your opinion, what happens to the justices who under oath said that it was settled law, settled precedent? You know this. You held a Supreme Court position for Washington State. It's a sacred position, one you must take seriously and do truthfully and with a clear conscience. How do they under oath say that and then this happens?
Well, I think what has to happen for the United States Senate Judiciary Committee is they can't simply accept the statements from these people anymore as truthful. They're going to have to dig behind them and really pin these people down on their opinions, because all of the people that were in the majority in this case all said, "Well, we respect precedent. We're not going to overturn precedent, as it has been handed to us by prior courts." Without really good cause. Well, they didn't have really good cause. The really good cause was their political views finally came to the forefront. Mm. That's not enough. And so you're going to have to make sure that, first of all, you elect presidents who appoint people that are legitimate justices for and judges for our federal courts. But more beyond that, you're going to have to really see these Senate Judiciary Committee hearings become far more aggressive about the individual views of these judges before they simply accept their statements, pat statements that are developed by, as a means of getting past the hearing process.
Well, the way they explained that away, Phil, was that in the court's opinion, Alito writes, under our precedents, the quality of the reasoning in a prior case has an important bearing on whether it should be reconsidered. And so he proceeds to lay out all the colossal mistakes that were made in Roe v. Wade and then lists all these state laws from the 1800s indicating that if there was any precedent at all, it was in favor of making abortion illegal.
Yeah, that's Alito's approach. And there's his textualism. Now, does the same textualism apply to the Second Amendment? You know, for purposes of a well-regulated militia, people have the right to keep and bear arms. Well, that suggests that the right to keep and bear arms is associated with your participation in the militia.
Correct. I'm sure they're going to enforce that, too, any day now.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they are, too, Dave. You know, I'm just waiting for that to happen. You know, it's the next shoe to drop at the Supreme Court, of course. But, you know, this is what I mean. It's situational analysis. It's situational analysis to get to the normative outcome that they want. They have no respect for the text of the Constitution. They have no more respect for the precedents that have been developed than the opponents that they decry. It just boggles the mind that they seem to think that there's no privacy protection inherent in the Constitution, and they make no mention of that point. But, you know, there are people that have been starting to start that drumbeat on the right wing that, well, contraceptive laws? No, we can ban contraceptives. You know, we don't have to have that.
So what do you think the reaction of that's going to be? So, yes, because I'm seeing that, too, and that makes sense. If there's no right to privacy, then it's everybody's business whether you're taking the pill or not. But
that's right.
What's different between now and 1973 is that we have a huge number of women in legislatures, in the Congress, and running corporations and making policy. Are they just, I mean, maybe they all support this, but I have a feeling a strong number do not. Are they just going to roll over?
No, and I don't think they will, but I think what it means is we're going to have, to Colleen's point, even more, you know, this is Justice Alito saying, well, you know, the Roe v. Wade has not settled the problem. Well, this opinion today doesn't settle the problem either from a political standpoint. It's going to make the political debate even more intense. What if, you know, some legislator and governor in Oklahoma or Alabama says no more contraceptives in our state after tomorrow?
They already have. They've taken away IUDs and they've already said corporations are people, and corporations say, hey, yeah, we don't like that birth control, even though it's non-hormonal and non-invasive, and they've taken it away. So
wouldn't there be economic consequences to that? We would get, there'd be a brain drain from those states, wouldn't there?
Well, I think there would be that, and I think there would be penalties that would be levied against those states, but it doesn't settle the problem is what I'm getting at. I mean, the notion that this, you know, somehow Roe didn't settle the problem of abortion and therefore it should be overturned because that's Justice Alito's normative position, it's a silly position because this decision today doesn't settle anything. It makes it, in fact, it puts all of these issues we're talking about up for grabs. And all sorts of consequences flow from that, as we've talked about. Corporations may react. The political system's going to react. You know, economic reactions. All sorts of things are going to take place. The problem doesn't get settled by this decision today. It only exacerbates a problem that already exists.
One more thing for you, since you were served in the legislature in the Supreme Court. Can you ever see a scenario here in Washington State where control changes hands and Washington State could, in fact, roll back our own privacy protections?
You know, I don't think so, because our state constitution actually specifically speaks to privacy. Mm-hmm. The thing that the right-wing justices have always relied upon is that there's nothing specific referencing privacy in the Bill of Rights or the United States Constitution's, original text. In our state constitution, there's a specific specific recognition of the right of privacy, and we've adopted an equal rights amendment in Washington to our constitution. So the combination of the specific reference to privacy rights in the constitution of the state of Washington plus the Equal Rights Amendment in the Washington State Constitution, I think, would make it extraordinarily difficult for someone to roll back those privacy rights, at least in our state. But that doesn't speak for the many, many, many other states that don't have an ERA and don't have similar kinds of specific privacy rights built into their state constitutions.
Former State Supreme Court Justice Phil Talmadge. Phil, thank you very much.
Happy to. Good to talk to you today.
You're listening to Cairo News Radio. We're going to go to political strategist Ron Dotsauer, who heads up the Strategies 360 consulting firm. And Ron, give us your initial reaction to this decision today to overturn Roe v. Wade.
Well, it's not exactly stunning because we already had a preview, didn't we?
Yes.
Of what's coming. I think the little surprise is Roberts sort of sitting on the sidelines in the 5-4, but it's probably one of the most, Dave, you've been around this almost as long as I have. But this is one of the most consequential Supreme Court decisions in the last 50 years.
So what does this mean for this is what the Republican Party wanted. This is why why a lot of people voted for Donald Trump, and it has now come true. So how does this change politics, if at all?
Well, I don't know that it's going to, other than the Supreme Court, it's certainly branded as probably one of the most conservative Supreme Courts we've had in our history. I think there's some consequences for Susan Collins, in Maine, and her conversation with Kavanaugh, who said he would not don't necessarily overturn Roe v. Wade, and boom, so she's a little embarrassed by it all. But it's going to change. I mean, listen, the states, the folks that are in poverty and the states that are going to outlaw abortions at all, it's going to have major consequences for them. Washington State, we're going to continue to support a woman's right to choose. And a lot of states are. So, I mean, it's going to change. I mean, people are going to move from state to state. They're going to be shopping. It's going to be a little mayhem, unfortunately. We don't know how it's all going to shake out at this point in time, but we know that there are significant consequences for everybody in America as a consequence of this decision.
Yeah, politically speaking, though, will this renew the efforts of women to run for political office? Will we see that wave?
That's a good question. There may be some of that. Now, one of the most national polls I've been tracking lately, while this has been a very emotional, very controversial issue, it is not rising to the level of basically changing voters' opinions in terms of how they're going to behave in this fall's election. So while the Democrats think that there's a chance it energizes some of the base voters and it may turn out more women, but long-term play is going to really change the outcome of this fall's elections when you have economy, inflation, gas prices. Those are going to dominate the landscape, in my opinion.
And probably in states where abortion will remain available in a safe haven for women, it's not very energizing, right? Because it's like, well, I still have the right, so why would I?
Well, I'm curious, Ron, how does this, I mean, you're steeped in polls. How does this issue break down along gender lines? Do a majority of women support the right to an abortion?
Majority of Americans do. Period.
Well, I'm just talking about women now. Among women, because they're the ones who have the street cred on this.
Oh yes, probably 2/3 of women voters. Okay, except for the very, very conservative female voters. Probably 60 to 65% of the women support a women's right to choose. Maybe a little bit higher than that. But more importantly, the word was just made in America across this country by a majority of voters. They all support a women's right to choose. Now, the Supreme Court doesn't look at polls.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, supposedly. All they're saying is there's no constitutional right here. So this now makes state legislative races that much more important, doesn't it?
Oh yes. Now that's what's going to happen. You're going to have those litmus test questions, okay, on legislative races like we haven't seen before. Again, at the end of the day, I don't know that it's a voting issue per se. Research hasn't demonstrated to me yet that it is. Now, that doesn't mean that it's not consequential in the sense that it can motivate a base of voters, both on the supportive side and also as well on the opposition side. So does it balance itself out? It tends to some level.
So, in other words, even at the state level, what do they call them, Slim Jims? All those little campaign flyers they hand out. Everybody's going to have to answer that abortion question now.
Everybody does every election. Am I wrong to say this, that every election, whether it's midterm or presidential, abortion becomes the final debate among political candidates? I've been through this my whole life. Yeah. Every time somebody wants to either win an election or win support, they talk about abortion. And
but not usually in state offices, though. That was always for federal offices. But now that's going to be, it seems to me, almost issue number one for anybody running for state office.
And I'll just say, as it is traumatizing to have that part of your life be used as political bait over and over again, and now it's just going to be even more traumatizing
it's
with what's going
accentuated.
On.
It has always been the litmus test for the Democrats on the one side of the issue and a litmus test for Republicans on the other side of this issue. What's going to happen now is going to be accentuated in terms of early support. Are you a D or are you an R, okay? And that's going to be one of the questions that will determine who you are politically.
So okay? I'm not sure if you've had a chance to look at the opinion, but you know what's next after this? I cannot confirm this quite yet, but I'm seeing a portion of a separate opinion brought by Justice Thomas in which he says something to the sort of now other precedents must be considered, and that includes, you know, the right for gay individuals to marry in this country. Is that next?
Mm-hmm. It could be. The way this court, you know, again, what they did on the gun legislation yesterday in New York and now this, listen, this court has been completely changed over. And you can expect all these opinions to reflect an extraordinarily conservative viewpoint on every major public policy issue going forward, as long as this court remains intact. That's what the public can expect going forward, absolutely, unequivocally. Right. And so this is more demonstration of that as we go forward. And this is going to be, you know, this is going to be, people expect that we're going to see these kinds of opinions. And I haven't had a chance to deep dive into the opinion today. I was struck by Roberts' kind of position, right? He was at a much more moderating view of this. And so it wasn't a 6-3, which is how a lot of things are coming out of court, but it was a 5-4 decision. So, again, what's going to change here, and David hit this right on, the fight now goes to the states. Okay, that's where the battle royale begins today for legislative races all over the country.
That is Ron Dotsauer, who heads up Strategies 360 consulting firm, a political strategist, talking about this historic moment of Roe v. Wade being overturned. Thank you so much for joining
us. We're all going to remember this day.
Absolutely.
Okay?
Yeah, we are.
8:43, Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Let's go to former State Attorney General Rob McKenna now. Rob, your reaction to the overturning of Roe v. Wade today?
Well, it's something I wouldn't have expected. If you'd asked me even a few years ago, Dave, I would have said, oh, that's not going to happen. You know, stare decisis, the concept of consistency in judicial rulings means that after nearly 50 years, this Roe v. Wade is solid. But Roe v. Wade is different. Yeah, and to be honest, it's one of those unique cases that's been very controversial from the very beginning, and it's been very polarizing. So I don't think this means we're going to see a tidal wave of major precedents being overturned. I think this is somewhat unique because of the issue of abortion.
I'm always curious, Rob, and especially since, you know, you are in a state where you were the attorney general as a Republican, all of that. When you see a sort of the politicization of the Supreme Court and the extreme viewpoints of Republicans today, how do you come to terms with that as a Republican yourself?
Well, I look at it as a citizen and as an attorney who cares a lot about the Constitution. It does concern me because it is very damaging to the credibility of the court as an institution in this state. So those are the ways I look at it to begin with. Secondly, as a Republican, this decision, which is the result of the Supreme Court now having 6 very conservative members, reminds me of how much the Republican Party has changed in the years that I've been involved. It is a party that is not being driven so much by economic policy, for example, as it is by social policy and culture. And there are a lot of people who are part of the party now who did participate before, and they're clearly having an effect. That's how Donald Trump became the nominee, over the opposition of a lot of us who are Republicans who didn't believe that he should be president.
And just like women ask men to be allies and be more outspoken than we are when it comes to our rights, to show that there's more than just, you know, women behind this, why are there not more Republicans such as yourself speaking out and going, this is the wrong direction for the party? I have not heard any strong statements from, you know, the old rhino GOP members going, hold on a second, this isn't what we signed up for as American Republicans.
There are very few pro-choice Republicans left in office today, just as there are very few pro-life Democrats left in office. The parties have gone through a kind of political centrifuge, and everything's spun out to the edges. The parties are much less diverse than they used to be ideologically, much more homogeneous ideologically today than they were even 10 years ago. And so there just aren't a lot of pro-choice Republicans out there to speak up and say that they're concerned with this decision. That's the basic answer to your question.
But in this opinion, Alito's opinion, I've only gotten to page 64 of the 213-page opinion here. He's saying that any way you look at it, the original decision, Roe v. Wade, that's what was the political decision. That wasn't based on any legal precedent or any tradition. It was completely flawed. It made up something in the Constitution that wasn't there. And I believe that technically he's correct. The Constitution never says you have the right to privacy. So he's just saying, hey, we're not making necessarily a moral judgment here, but we're also saying that the Constitution doesn't make this moral judgment. And since we're here to uphold the Constitution, that's why we're ruling this way.
Right. And that's an argument that that Alito and others have been making for a long time, is that it's dangerous for the federal courts to create rights that didn't exist. There is a way to create new constitutional rights. You know, it's amending the Constitution. And that's why 18-year-olds have the right to vote. It's why women have the right to vote, et cetera. You know, this is how the system is designed. And there's a lot of evidence that before Roe v. Wade, the country was generally trending towards more rights to an abortion on a state-by-state basis. And the pro-life movement was born out of Roe v. Wade. It didn't really exist as a force before Roe v. Wade. So there's this enormous unintended consequence that's been created by Roe v. Wade that's resulted in tremendous polarization driven people to choose sides. Perhaps that wouldn't have happened if the Supreme Court had not found a new right in the Constitution that no one had noticed before. But that's all water over the dam at this point. It has been a right established in law for about 50 years, and now it's thrown back to the states. And there are going to be a lot of states with these trigger laws that are already passed that are basically going to make it impossible to obtain a legal abortion in their states, which means women will have to travel to other states to find those services.
I'm very focused on sort of the next, because I think, you know, when this Supreme Court document leaked, we were able to work through what this means, the trigger laws, the other states that will then roll in, what's Washington going to do to, you know, infrastructure-wise, medical infrastructure-wise, to keep up with women crossing the border to access these services. But now I'm looking at, you know, the right to privacy laws, as Dave, you brought up earlier, corporate tech companies now using our private information however they please. We're thinking about our gay friends on this Pride Month and what it means as the Supreme Court signals they're going to look to overturn their right to marry in this nation. So, you know, it's not just women right now who are affected by this decision, but pretty much everybody's privacy. And that is such a huge linchpin in liberal and conservative thought, is the government cannot take my money. The government cannot spy on me. The government cannot come in my house and take my gun. That is a right to privacy. So where does this stop?
Yeah, we don't know yet. The court makes rulings on a case-by-case, issue-by-issue basis. So I wouldn't assume anything yet about what the implications of this decision are for other precedents that are based on a right to privacy. In terms of marriage, marriage has been found to be a fundamental right that it has deep roots in our country's history. So it may be better protected. But on the other hand, in that history of the country, it was construed to be marriage between a man and a woman. So right. It also could be at risk. And therefore, I think people who depend on rights founded in privacy are properly concerned about where the court goes from here.
Well, and they said in their opinion, I'm not sure if you've gotten to it. I know you've been busy this morning with clients, but in the opinion this morning, it mm-hmm. says, for that reason, in future cases, we should reconsider all of this court's substantive due process precedents. And that includes, privacy in the bedroom, the right to marry between same-sex couples.
Right. So I've gotten far enough into the opinion to be able to see that they're setting out a substantive due process framework that says that substantive due process is either about specifically enumerated rights like free speech that date back to the founding of the country into the Constitution, and they relate to other rights that can be found in the Constitution implicitly. So they're going to have to decide if there's any right to privacy at all grounded in the Constitution. I think that's going to turn in part on whether a right to privacy is essential to this concept of what's called ordered liberty. Is it one of our liberty rights to have privacy? I think there's a pretty strong case to be made that liberty does depend in part on privacy.
Yeah, that's the whole banana.
Yeah.
Because in your property, you can tell the government, hey, none of your business, unless I am actively harming somebody else, none of your business. Of course, that harm
right.
part, they now extend to the fetus in the womb. Let me ask you this.
Because I want to
get another attorney's opinion on this. Would there be any value in pushing for a constitutional amendment providing the right to privacy?
Sure, there would be value because that's the proper way to create a new constitutional right. It's the most long-lasting way to create a new constitutional right, amend the Constitution. The challenge with it, of course, is the difficulty in amending the Constitution, which is why we haven't done it for many decades. You need two-thirds of the state of the U.S. Senate and two-thirds of the House of Representatives to approve it. Then you have to send the amendment to the state legislatures, and majorities and three-quarters of our nation's state legislatures have to also approve it. If you push for a constitutional amendment on privacy, will the pro-life, anti-abortion groups oppose it because they're afraid it'll open the door to a federal constitutional right to abortions? So it'll be challenging. But procedurally, that's exactly what we're supposed to do, and we think it's important enough to establish a new right, whether it's the right
you don't
to vote
think a,
or what have you.
You don't think a constitutional right to privacy would be very popular among small government Republicans who don't want the government interfering in their private lives?
Yeah, well, it should be. I would support it, but it'll get tangled up in the abortion issue. Why? Because in Roe v. Wade, they decided to ground the right to an abortion in this concept of privacy. If they hadn't done that, it might not be so controversial.
Former State Attorney General Rob McKenna, thanks for jumping in, Rob. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks, Dave. Thanks, Colleen.
Seattle's Morning News, Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. The issue of salmon runs has been in the news as long as I've been here, which is a long time. And the Yakima Nation is now trying to get some action on restoring those salmon runs. Let's talk with Council Member Jeremy Takala of the Yakima Nation. First of all, let's talk about the damage caused by the Columbia River and Snake River dams. What did the runs used to be?
Mm-hmm. I mean, we're talking about, 17 million historically.
What's the number now?
We barely not even make a million. I mean, our fish are at risk. We have quasi-extinction in the Snake River Basin that Nez Perce has been following closely. You're talking about barely 50, making it back.
I'm unfamiliar with what the treaty actually says. So are there numbers? Is the state obligated to ensure a certain number of fish?
We're a treaty tribe that has the right to harvest, hunt, and gather in usual and custom area.
Right.
And so with that being said, we have a rightful take to these fish as well. The thing here for Yakima is we're not responsible for these hydro systems put in place. They have violated our treaty rights. And so with that being said, we're trying to fix the mistakes that were put in place by, the hydro systems and so on. So We're trying to get this picture right, as we have a responsibility to look after our natural resources. And, you know, when we talk about natural resources, we're talking about our foods that are very important to us, such as fish and the wildlife.
Right. But is there no, I know there have been efforts to barge the fish around the dams and various other things to hatcheries to try and restore the runs. But you're saying none of that has worked.
It hasn't been. But at the same time, you know, we also we're talking about mitigation. You know, the time is now. You know, you need to make sure that, you know, you put the tribes and the states directly in charge of the fisheries restoration. It doesn't make sense when we have energy managing Columbia Basin fisheries restoration.
So you would like to take over the mitigation operation then?
Yes. The region in our area has identified approximately 1 billion in shovel-ready actions at the dams, estuaries, predator gathering locations, and other key areas in the main stem Columbia and the Snake River, as well as approximately 520 million in fish passage projects at the four Bureau of Reclamation dams and reservoirs in the Yakima River Basin, and over 700 million in deferred maintenance on regional federal hatchery infrastructure. These are ready to go, regionally recommended projects.
So this is stuff that does not require the dam removal?
It has to work hand in hand. Uh-huh. I mean, again, it has to be on the table for discussion and analysis.
But I'm saying in terms of some of the, I mean, dam removal is going to take a while, obviously, and then the runs would have to rebuild. So are you saying if these projects went ahead, you could see recovery maybe by next season or two seasons or what?
We have seen some of it work, but at the same time, you know, we all know what's knocking at our doors, which is climate change.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's the thing with hydro system is, you know, there's a huge demand there in the summer periods. But at the same time, you know, it's a reservoir or lake, a system of lakes. We face migrations that are being paused or stopped, such as last year we've seen some sockeye that had stopped migrating because there was no flow and then the warming river temperatures were impacting them. So
you want to see more water released is what you're saying?
Yes, at the same time. It all has to work hand in hand.
So you would like to be then in charge of regulating the water flow through the dams to mitigate the damage to the fish run?
Yes.
And you're not being allowed to do that now?
There's been some barriers set in place. The number one message that we need to send to everyone is, you know, we need to put fish and all our other natural resources in the front. You know, we need to be mindful of them because
right. So in other words, if the electricity generation suffers, so be it. You have to preserve the fish.
Well, again, with the Simpson proposal, you know, there's new ideas that we need to might want to think about.
So who is Congressman Simpson and what is he proposing?
Mike Simpson, Idaho congressman. You know, I know he's a good friend of the Nez Perce tribe. He made his proposal on the removal of the Lower Snake River dams. You know, there was a big package deal that, you know, dealt with the ag, the transportation, recreational use, and energy replacement.
So explain to us, if you were just given the power to manage the dams according to what's best for the fish, what do you think that would mean for power generation?
The new approach here is talking about energy replacement.
Which would mean, building other power plants or what?
Well, I mean, I think we all know, you know, Governor Inslee had this approach on the green energy, but there is concerns on green energy too for Yakima Nation, because many of these projects that are being proposed are in the Yakima Nation lands on the east side of the Cascades. I think we need to step back and determine where these green energy projects can be placed without impacting, you know, root gathering grounds, wildlife grounds, and shrub steppe. And, you know, I think that's something that we can come to the table and talk about, and then, you know, kind of keep that balance of energy replacement with the dams. And
you know, you're talking about wind turbines now?
Yeah, we have some turbines in our areas.
If the turbines are not the solution, then what is the solution to keeping the lights on?
There's all different ideas. There's the solar panel projects. There's also small modular reactors, which, you know, we also have concerns about. But again, I think it's determining what is appropriate, what is, you know, environmentally friendly and what isn't. I mean,
Well, you mentioned these nuclear reactors, this new generation nuclear reactors, which is supposed to be smaller and safer. But, you know, you say the word nuclear and people sort of freak out. And, but I mean, are you open to that kind of solution?
If we can have a deep conversation with the Yakima Nation, you know, I'm sure you know, we can see what can and cannot work. I mean, I'll just say like this, you know, when the hydro systems were put into place, you know, none of that conversation has ever happened with the tribes, you know, basically violated our treaty. And now, you know, we're in 2022, you know, and we're seeing where our salmon and steelhead stocks are, you know, they're in a crisis, sir. So this is very important. We're all going to be impacted by this if, you know, we see, you know, our salmon and steelhead go to extinction.
Councilman Jeremy Takala of the Yakima Nation. Thank you very much, Jeremy.
Thank you.
We had quite a long chat about this, and it's been a long time since we've really covered this issue much. But, of course, the conflict between dams and fish has been there for a long time. What I was impressed by was that he wasn't taking one of these positions saying, blow up all the dams right away, because the Yakima Nation needs the electricity as well. But he's saying they want a stronger voice in it because he feels that the fish have come second. And I don't know if you remember the controversies back in the '80s over this Tennessee snail darter and, you know, preserving endangered species. It was sort of dismissed as how ridiculous to preserve a stupid little organism like that when it would cost people electricity. But he holds ancestral memories of these huge salmon runs. It was even said back in the day that there were so many salmon in the Columbia, you could cross
just
the river.
One. Yeah.
You could cross the river walking on their backs.
That
was a thing. And so he feels the tribe has a right to do this. And I hope he gets his way. I hope that they get the power to have that, to have a stronger voice than they've had up until now.
What I've seen time and time again growing up here, growing up next to the Tulalip Indian Reservation, you know, having just done a story with the Quinault Nation opening that wellness center for opioid treatment abuse, is that the tribes do what's best for the masses and they do what's best for nature. That is in their culture. It's in their ancestry. It's in their hearts and minds. And it's how they move through the world. And so I think we do need to open our ears and minds and listen, because often what they are recommending and suggesting for the better of the people and for nature is what's going to lead us to prosperity, right? From the wellness center to making sure the salmon and the orcas have food, and we'll find a way to have electricity too.
Yeah,
we've invented many ways
thing.
To have electricity.
He was pointing out that with more, the release of more salmon, the orcas will come back as well. And he also, and so will the sports fishermen, because there was a smaller dam that was taken out, and within a year, the runs came back.
Yeah. Listen to our friends on the reservations, please.
In the nation's northwest corner is Washington.
And here it is Friday, time for our resident historian Felix Bunnell to join us for All Over the Map, where he looks at the stories behind local places and things. And if you know where to look, it turns out you can hike in the Cascades right past the remnants of what used to be a sprawling nationwide transportation network. What are we talking about?
Well, it sounds like something from the railroads, maybe like an old depot or a roundhouse, but it's actually something a little different. Now, I saw a post on social media a few weeks ago by a guy named Brian Dirks, included some photos of this particular artifact, which he stumbled across on a hike to Easton Ridge over on the backside of Snoqualmie Pass. Brian's in his 60s. He's retired, lives in South King County, goes on a lot of trails around the area with his twin brother and some other friends in a hiking group. Now, they're up on Easton Ridge at about 4,400 feet. Brian noticed a big rock pile, or maybe what you'd call a rock scramble. He said he's a little afraid of heights, but he saw an obviously milled piece of lumber sticking out from the rocks, like a big railroad tie. So he scrambled up to the top of the pile to take a closer look.
At the top, I found a flattened area, and there were actually two of these railroad tie looking things, and they were spread out, you know, maybe 6 feet apart. And my first thought was that it was an old fire lookout station. Also by the side, I should mention, not on the rock pile, but along the side of it, was some old corrugated sheet metal. There's just kind of lying there in a heap. So it kind of piqued my curiosity.
Something about that combination of being out in nature and seeing some man-made artifact, that just like makes the back of my neck tingle just thinking about
it.
So he went home, did some research. It wasn't a lookout tower. It wasn't from the railroad. It was the base of what used to be an airway beacon tower.
What?
A very romantic part of the old way that airmail flyers and other aviators used to get across the country, right? Going back to the 1920s. It was an early network. It marked routes all across the country. They're in tops of mountains, on tops of buildings, like the Northern Life Tower in downtown Seattle. They're part of what's called the Transcontinental Airways, you know, this whole system of routes around the country. started going up in the late 1920s. Private oil companies put up their own versions of these things with the blessing of the Commerce Department. Even Richfield Oil had planned to have a whole network from Canada to Mexico that collapsed because of the Great Depression. But this was a going thing for about 10 years. They were outmoded by radio navigation as early as the late 1930s.
So what kind of beacons? Did they have electricity up there?
That's the really cool part. Because there's no electricity up there, on this 30-foot tower, there was an acetylene-powered flame. And a big tank of acetylene that they only had to maintain twice a year. You have 6 months worth of acetylene.
And it was constantly burning.
Burned 24 hours a day. And it must have had some kind of a valve that made it blink. Like some sort of an oscillating valve.
So like it was a lighthouse.
Exactly. And there's no lighthouse keeper. And you only had to go every 6 months to refill the tank with acetylene. It was 2 million candle power. You probably could see it during the day. It was probably like a star.
So was the idea to prevent the planes from crashing into mountains? Or?
Yeah, and also mark a route. Because before air navigation, before navigation charts were easily distributed, you have to have some way to just visually look down. And planes flew pretty low in those days. You weren't up in the, you know, because the cabins weren't pressurized. So it's this incredibly romantic system, probably, you know, these lights burning 24 hours a day.
I had no idea.
Some oil companies even put the names of towns on the roof of their buildings.
So have you mapped these out so we can hike to them?
There's a couple in the near the Eastern Ridge one. There's Ketches Lake nearby. There's one. There's more of the towers still standing. Down in Toledo, Washington, there's a complete tower still standing. And there's probably remnants and pieces all over the country. They actually, it was about 1965 when the FAA finally said, we can start decommissioning some of these because the radio beacons have taken over.
Right.
And visual flyers don't need this kind of stuff anymore because you can follow highway paths and that sort of thing. So
I had no idea.
Yeah. So just Eastern Ridge Trail to see the one that Brian Dirks found.
Felix Bonnell, all his features at MyNorthwest.com. This is Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. Joining us now, the host of CBS's Face the Nation, Margaret Brennan. Well, I found yesterday's session of the January 6th committee pretty interesting because we got to see inside that Oval Office meeting where the president was considering firing his acting attorney general in favor of someone who would sign an untrue letter on Justice Department letterhead. Now, did we know about this before?
A lot of this had been reported by journalists in public reporting that has been out there. It is another matter to see individuals, law enforcement officials under oath, giving sworn testimony alongside taped depositions from White House officials who worked for President Trump himself. I mean, that is what this hearing does, is it lays out in fact what is really indisputable when you have these sworn testimonies. You can cry fake news all you want, but when you hear Trump White House officials say this conversation happened in front of the president and this is what I told him, it makes it harder for Republicans to continue to disassociate here and say that this wasn't directly ordered by the president. It makes it harder to minimize the violence of January 6th as just a riot gone wrong.
I mean, Nixon ended up resigning because he tried to get the FBI to do illegal things, and it sounds like Trump was trying to get, I mean, he was trying to launch a wide-scale FBI Justice Department investigation into something that didn't happen.
Well, this was, and look, I mean, the details of this, I think sometimes people, you can get tangled in it, and then you step back, and it's breathtaking when you have some of these law enforcement officials say the president of the United States was talking about the Justice Department and Homeland Security seizing voting machines. I mean, that's stunning when you hear them say, as we did, that the acting attorney general told the president, you are going to put an incompetent person in charge of the Justice Department to carry out your scheme, which, by the way, is illegal. And by the way, if you do this, every top law enforcement official at the Department of Justice will resign. 48 attorneys general. I mean, that's stunning. So this is what we were really seeing laid out before the public in this hearing yesterday.
So the president can't really argue, oh, my attorneys told me this was okay, because he's going to bring up that John Eastman memo. It doesn't sound like he can use that excuse.
Well, there's a difference between a personal attorney and the attorney for the United States of America. And the attorneys for the United States of America and its Constitution, the Department of Justice, were telling the president, you cannot do this. It is illegal. It is unconstitutional. It is a scheme. It will not be held up in court. And by the way, it, you know, you're handpicking people to act as messengers for you rather than upholding the law. Rudy Giuliani or John Eastman are acting as attorneys for the president to see through his scheme. That's the difference between the attorneys here. And that is what we were hearing from the Justice Department lawyers who were saying to the president, you know, in as many words, you know, we don't work for you. We work for the Constitution. Yeah.
Is this indictable?
So that is the million-dollar question here, is what is being laid out in the Capitol hearings something that can ultimately inform a Justice Department investigation or prosecution? And what I hear from law enforcement and from former officials is that this reminds them in many ways of kind of a mob boss investigation, where you look at those who are lower level and have information that you can prosecute around, rather than looking at prosecuting the president of the United States or former president of the United States, which would be an incredibly high benchmark, unprecedented, and also highly controversial in a divided America. But this is something that the Justice Department ultimately has to make a decision on whether they want to pursue or not.
Well, a divided America. What's the? I mean, what is the Republican explanation excusing this?
Well, from the Republican officials who testified under oath this week, there was no excusing of it. In fact, the Arizona election official, Republican, the Georgia election officials, Republicans, were not excusing it. They were laying it out, saying we were not going to violate our oath to the Constitution of the country or to the state, and in fact refused to do what the president was pressuring them to do. They're not excusing it. Mm-hmm. In terms of whether the party is willing to continue to look to Donald Trump's ability to galvanize voters and galvanize support among his base, and if that is enough to you know, make them fear essentially the political power there, is another question. And that is a choice for the Republican Party going into 2024 as it looks to potentially consider the former president as a nominee.
CBS's Margaret Brennan, Face the Nation Sunday. Margaret, thank you.
Thank you.
.747 Seattle's Morning News, and joining us now is Travis Mayfield in for G. Scott. Good morning. Oh. So what do you think? As a married gay man, in case people don't know.
Yeah. I mean, there's so many things. First, I think about, you know, we have an almost 9-year-old daughter who will apparently grow up in a country with less rights than the country that I grew up in. That's a remarkable state of affairs, a heartbreaking state of affairs. You know, I also look at how our kids came to be. IVF, in vitro it's too early. My brain is not working. And that, you know, there's a story this morning in the Wall Street Journal about how IVF clinics around the country are moving embryos that are, you know, in refrigerators and on ice in states where personhood laws or fetal viability laws, where, you know, they're worried that that could be illegal.
Because in that procedure, eggs that are defective in some way are just tossed out.
That's right.
Fertilized embryos. Yeah.
That's exactly right.
You wouldn't have Grayson without the ability to preserve embryos.
Right. I mean, our kids are because of that. I mean, our story is we had twins who were born through IVF, and daughter and son, and 2 years into that, our son Tommy died unexpectedly and horrifically, and we had still some viable embryos left from our round of IVF. And we went back to the clinic and we found one, and we transferred it into our surrogate, and we have our rainbow baby because of that. But if that had happened today in a state where personhood laws exist, I mean, that couldn't have happened. Mm-hmm. We couldn't be dads to begin with.
So at this point, what do you think? Do people – is this the beginning of the great sort where people just start to move to states whose rules allow them to create their families?
I don't know. I mean, that's exactly – because I imagine things like – I mean, I already was in a place where I've been, if we're planning a family vacation, flying across the country, being worried about having layovers in places where they will scream groomer at my husband and I because we have our kids. Like, literally, I know that seems reactionary, but like, that is where my mind has been in the last number of years. Mm-hmm. And now I imagine, again, like, women on vacation who might be pregnant and they're in Florida or Texas, like, I would be afraid to vacation if I were pregnant in a state like that for fear of what might happen. I mean, there's this story this morning in the Seattle Times about this woman who was in Malta who could get an abortion, had to like medevac basically to Spain to save her life.
And to be clear, she was having a miscarriage,
yes,
which is why she needed abortion. So for those that don't realize it, when you miscarry, not all the fetal tissue can pass. And so you need an abortion, or that fetal tissue will rot in your uterus.
And kill
and you.
You
will die.
Yeah, kill you.
So when we talk, this is why I need us so badly on this radio station especially to talk in the gray area, to stop talking about it as preserving life and killing life, but to understand that abortion services are used for more than just what your extreme mindset goes
right
to.
That's exactly, I mean,
please,
like I said, IVF. Fetal viability is a different question than what you at home think that it is.
Yes, in everyday life.
And in getting in there and saying that it's no longer a doctor and a family's decision, that now it is lawmakers' decision.
Mm-hmm.
It will cost us lives.
Mm. So do you think this will end up being extended to your marriage?
I don't know. That's my other big fear here is, I mean, the leaked draft of this basically said that this rests on the idea that we don't really have a right to privacy. That's not in the Constitution. And that's where the basis of, you know, saying that sodomy laws were unconstitutional, where ultimately getting to a point where states could no longer criminalize being gay.
You know what the remedy is? Constitutional amendment.
Yeah.
You think there'd be support for now a constitutional amendment granting the right to privacy?
What's interesting is that when you talk about these specific issues, I just read this HRC poll, a Human Rights Commission poll. The support for same-sex families is higher than it's ever been in this country. It's like 70 to 80% of the country.
But that's not reflected in our Congress.
How can
that's the problem.
How
Travis.
Can even small government people justify the government breaking up your marriage?
I don't know. Exactly. Like, or would we remain married in Washington and then I have a layover in Missouri and suddenly we're not married? I mean, that's a wild situation to imagine, but that's where we were before we had Obergefell. Like, that's exactly where we were. We were married in some states and not in other states. For my whole life, I've thought we were making progress, and here we are taking a 50-year step backwards.
Yeah.
Travis Mayfield, who joins Spike O'Neill for The Gene Ursula Show, starting at 9. Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News, the podcast. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. You can find our podcast weekday mornings right at 9:30.
And if you subscribe, you'll never miss the Daily Dose of Kindness.